Hi, I'm Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Globe and Mail's Andrea Wu joins me now. We'll discuss her work in the BC Bureau of Canada's largest circulation national newspaper, as well as current affairs, stuff that you see reported in the paper and online, carrying her byline. It's a name we've read in the Vancouver Sun, where she was at from 2009 to 2012, when she left to join the Globe and Mail. Prior to that, she was at Metro. She was a music journalist as well, appearing in Exclaim, Pound, the Georgia Strait, the Seattle Stranger, and The Source. It'll be interesting to get her take on the news and her work and the place that newspapers have in our culture today. And perhaps we'll find out why she chose journalism as her line of work. Andrea Wu is a two-time recipient of the Jack Webster Award, among many other honors. The website for more is at andreawu.com. The Twitter handle is at Andrea Wu. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in studio, as it were, Andrea Wu. Ms. Wu, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This is an afternoon, but we're pretending it's morning.
Okay, well, now you just gave it away.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
You messed up.
I did. I apologize. When I read your bio online, the emphasis, I don't know if it's the emphasis, but this is what jumped out at me, was the word multimedia in your title. You're a multimedia reporter. I suppose that news reporters before you weren't filing on different platforms as you do. You write for the morning paper, I suppose. You also tweet. You write for the website during the day. You upload, shoot photos, videos for the website. Mm-hmm. I guess that's a reality. I mean, the journals that come out of J school nowadays, they have to be nimble on these various platforms.
Definitely. I mean, I call myself a multimedia journalist, and that's my title, but in reality, I think everyone is probably doing it to some extent.
Was it a big leap, say, to have to do what you do? I mean, is it a big leap? I mean, you know how journalists work, say, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Does it seem like a more difficult job, an easier job, say? I don't know how that works for someone.
I mean, it's fun and it's exciting that we have all these different platforms to play around with now. But at the same time, we don't have the luxury that a reporter might have had 15, 20 years ago, where you have several days to go somewhere and find the story and talk to everyone. I mean, we have some really stressful deadlines now. We don't have the money that we used to, don't have the travel budgets that we used to. So I guess we're kind of compensating with finding different ways to tell the story.
Is a deadline earlier because you work for, say, a Toronto paper than if you were at the Sun?
At the Sun, I don't know if it's still the same, but we had two deadlines then. One was about 6 o'clock, one was about 10 o'clock. So that was pretty nice to be able to work on something until 10 if we had to. At the Globe now, we try to file by 4:30.
Yeah.
And sometimes the news is still happening. Yeah. And so.
That was a big deal when you left the Sun, if I recall. I mean, people were saying that it was a loss for the Sun and a gain for the Globe and Mail.
Were people saying that?
Yeah, I read some tweets that people were saying that, yeah.
Thanks, Mom.
The Globe and Mail is for whatever people might say about that newspaper, I mean, that's still a pretty big brand in this country. Yeah. I mean, that must have been something that you were keenly aware of when you did move.
I really liked working at the Sun, and I'm still in touch with a lot of my friends there. I think I just wanted to do something bigger picture. Like, I was working on the night shift at the Sun for much of my time there, so it was a lot of, if someone got shot at night, it's like, go and do that story. But it was, like, very, very Vancouver-centric. So I wanted the challenge, and I'm definitely getting it at the Globe, where their saying is to try to explain BC to the rest of Canada. So that can be really stressful sometimes. Like, what does this mean? Instead of just covering the day-to-day stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to be writing about, say, the intersection of Kingsway and Fraser.
Right.
You're just going to mention that it's in East Vancouver, probably. Is that sort of...
Something like, yeah. Yeah, we don't use a lot of street addresses.
Yeah. The sort of skills that one needs to be a journalist, because I'm a consumer of news, and I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to us who are interested in the news and perhaps even thinking of going into your line of work. Do you find that the sort of skills that one needs are ones that can be taught, or are these things that you have to have, like a natural curiosity, obviously, can't be taught to someone?
I mean, I think it's a little of both. Like, more and more, the technical side of it is probably more important. I don't know what they teach at J school now, but when I was there, I mean, we were still developing our photos in the dark room. And then I get into to a newsroom, it's like, well, we're transmitting the news via hologram now. It's like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, you definitely need that natural curiosity. This isn't a 9-to-5 job. You are never really off.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the make or break thing. Everything else, I think, can be taught. I mean, you can teach someone how to use a video camera. You can teach someone how to, you know, tweet and write web files and all that stuff.
I remember there was a restaurant had burst into flames in front of Kingsgate Mall, and you were tweeting about it, and you were filing at the same time.
Yeah.
For the website, and then essentially what you wrote was in the paper the next day.
Okay.
That sort of stuff, I mean, that happens all the time. I mean, if you're just in the neighborhood and then you come across something, you're on duty, essentially?
That's actually a good example, because I was off sick that day, and I'd finally mustered enough energy to go to the store, and I'd come outside my apartment, I was like, ah, fuck.
Yeah.
So there's this massive fire. But yeah, I mean, I was at, where was I? I can't remember if I was at the Globe or at the Sun at the time. But yeah, so it was big enough, and I was right there, so yeah, you're on.
Is it, oh, fuck, that you have to work, or that the building's on fire?
A little of both. A little from column A, a little from column B.
Yeah,
yeah, I actually lost power in my apartment that night, but I ended up filing via iPhone from the street.
Yeah, and see, that's something that you couldn't do 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I hear some people complaining about it now, like, you're not being paid a lot more, but you're doing a lot more work.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think to people who are comfortable with this, with filing constantly, it really doesn't seem like more of a chore. I mean, if anything, I think it seems like a luxury to not have to do any of this and only file one print story a day or less than that.
And so do you have a beat? I mean, or are you just one of these reporters that see, I mean, because when I read you online or in the paper, you seem to write about a lot of things.
I'm kind of a catch-all. I mean, we have... we definitely have beat reporters in the BC Bureau. Like, Mark Hume is the environmental reporter. Wendy Stook does a lot of the First Nation stuff.
Yeah.
But no, I'm just kind of a everything else reporter.
And so you must have interests, or you must have issues that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
And do you find that you're able to write about those things? I mean, I don't know if the Globe and Mail has hip-hop writing in there, but...
Globe and Mail, not so much about the rap music, no. the Globe's been very good that way. I mean, we go into the morning meetings every day and kind of go around the table, like, what are you looking at today? So we do have a lot of freedom in that sense. If something comes up and no one is on it yet and it's important, then I might be assigned a story. But for the most part, we have a lot to say.
And you got a lot of great talent in that bureau, don't you? I mean, from the columnists, just as the reporters that you've already mentioned.
Yeah.
And some that you haven't. I mean, it's the quality of work that comes out of that bureau, you, it's quite clear for me as a news consumer.
Yeah. This is part of my reason for coming to the Globe, just because I wanted that push and to be surrounded by people of that caliber. I mean, one of my first morning meetings there, I was just like struggling to come up with impressive ideas because I'm the new person.
Yeah.
And we're going around the table, and I think Mark Hume said something like, oh, the largest environmental disaster just occurred off the coast of blah, 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 and I have all these sources. And they come around to me, I was like, someone was stabbed in Surrey. So, I mean, it definitely pushes me to work harder and find better stories.
Well, what are some of the challenges for your job today? Because when I follow journalists on Twitter, there's a lot of talk of the difficulty of getting information from, say, City Hall, from agencies, various agencies of the government. Access to information, obviously, is something that you're concerned about because it affects the way that you do your job.
Absolutely.
For me as a news consumer, as a citizen, these are things that have to concern me, don't
Absolutely.
They?
Absolutely. And I do gripe about a lot on Twitter, and it's not just because I'm complaining, because they bother me. I've had people say that, you know, no one cares about how hard it is to do your job, but it's not about it being difficult for me. It's about access to information, information that we have a right to know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, just even trying to get a minister on the phone is like damn near impossible sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that you know, this person was not available for comment sometimes isn't enough. Like, I think you have a responsibility to show people just how much they're really going out of their way to keep information from you sometimes. Like, there's this game that we play every day, and it's like, oh, well, I'll try to get the minister on the phone, and then at 5 o'clock, it's like, can't get the minister, but here's a statement. And then a lot of the times you'll see a statement that was probably crafted by some communications person running the newspaper. It's like, that was not an interview. You didn't get to ask any of the questions. It's like they're talking at us. This was not a conversation.
Yeah, that's a debate that I see a lot on Twitter, whether you use the statement provided to you by the FLAC as a quote for your story. Where do you fall on that? I mean, where does the Globe and Mail... Because there's some people that do run it, because I get the same press releases sometimes, and I see the exact same lines in the news stories the next day, and then some outlets refuse to do that. Yeah. What's your take on all of that?
I know the Georgia Straits policy is absolutely no emailed statements. Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on what the statement is. If it's just some complete fluff, like, you know, we will continue to work with blah, blah, blah to accomplish blah, it's like that means absolutely nothing. If it does have some sort of useful information, I may say that this minister has either refused to comment or has declined an interview, but in an emailed statement said blah, blah, blah. I think that's fair.
Yeah. What we see in the newspapers that we read in the morning or online throughout the day, is that stuff that we ought to know about because you as a reporter think we need to know about that, or is there a lot of it's in the paper because the public finds that sort of topic interesting? Like, I mean, do editors think about those things, like, this will play well on page one because our audience is interested in, I don't know, pipelines or the economy?
I think a lot of the times it gets so micro, like, yeah, everyone's kind of looking at other newspapers too, but with the Globe, the readership is definitely very interested in BC politics, pipelines, so those are stories that generally play a pretty big, but yeah, there's
because we see that in the, I guess, the broadcast journalism and the radio and the television, that the sort of stuff that a particular outlet will cover is because it's either in reaction to something that the other outlets are covering,
sometimes,
or perhaps they have their core audience, or they know what sells, I guess, or what lead, you know, if it'll sell well for them.
A lot of the times we kind of defer to the beat reporter too, so we'll go to Mark Hume. It's like, is this important? What do you think?
And so I mean, you must hear from the public, and you must hear from them about what they're concerned about. Does that have an influence, say, in terms of what you report on?
Yeah, I think that's one of the big benefits of Twitter. You can just ask people immediately whether or not this is something you care about. Why? What element of it? What do you want us to look into?
We hear polls all the time of how journalists are regarded in the community, and this is not just in this part of the world, but throughout, I guess, North America, that you're just slightly above, say, lawyers and politicians. Does that play into... I mean, do you encounter that sort of animus from people when you're on the street covering a story, say?
I think it depends. I mean, a lot of it is, I think, your attitude and how you approach situations. I mean, if you're going to a downtown East Side protest or something, and you're a giant guy with a big obnoxious camera, like, I think that automatically kind of, you know, ruffles some feathers. If you're sympathetic, and like, I'm pretty small, I can usually kind of blend in pretty well.
Something that I found quite interesting on Twitter in the last week or so was the reaction to the Jeff O'Neill Sea Fox thing. Because a lot of the reaction that I found most effective wasn't necessarily from the public. I mean, the public, if you listen to Sea Fox regularly and you're a fan of the Jeff O'Neill show, what was heard on the radio last week, the F. Mary Kill thing, you probably wouldn't bat an eyebrow because you're used to that sort of talk on that program, on that particular show. What interested me was the reaction from journalists. There weren't very many that were defending Mr. O'Neill and what happened on Sea Fox, but the people that were definitely opposed to what had happened. What did you make of that? And do you think that sort of the discourse is elevated because of what happened in that situation?
I find it incredibly surprising that someone would think that it is okay to joke about killing the Prime Minister's wife on the radio. Like, I understand what they were trying to do. It's supposed to be sort of like a boys talk locker room type thing, but like, that's not okay. And social media, like, people are going to let you know if they're not happy right now. I think you got to be a little bit more sensitive than that.
And do you think that because of the experience coming out of the Cosby situation, out of the Gomeshi matter, that this was such a lightning rod of discussion on Twitter? I mean, it certainly affected Mr. O'Neill and the show. Drex had to apologize for what... Right. I mean, he didn't even say... I mean, he defended, I guess, the comment in terms of... called it fair in terms of comedy. Are we at a place in society where those sorts of discussion, F, marry, kill, won't happen on broadcast radio anymore?
I think so. I mean, I think with Twitter, with social media, everything is kind of amplified a lot more, and you have to be a lot more careful with your words now. And then once the attention is drawn onto it, I mean, it just kind of snowballs to it. You can't joke about that kind of thing.
Did you find after the Gomeshi case, especially, that we're talking about issues of abuse, has the media coverage of that, has that changed a great deal? I mean, I think it has. I mean, just speaking as a consumer, but I mean,
how do you think the media coverage has changed?
I think people have spent time to think of. I mean, you saw this, I don't know if you watched The Newsroom or not, but the episode before the last one, there was a scene in there where they were talking about rape, and who does one believe when a woman accuses someone of rape? Do they believe the victim, or do they believe the accused a lot more? And the character on the Newsroom said that he, as a news producer, would... the onus is on the victim, because the victim would have to... And that just created a firestorm on Twitter, blaming Aaron Sorkin for his obtuse views, which I happen to agree with, that he appeared backwards in his whatever he was writing. That sort of discussion, I remember, what really surprised me was the New Yorker had reviewed that episode. Mm-hmm. And the TV critic at the New Yorker had said, in particular, that this episode may have... been okay or acceptable a year or so ago, but after the Gomeshi case, and which also surprised me that the New Yorker was aware of the Gomeshi case, that this stuff is not okay and this stuff shouldn't be tolerated, even if it's a TV drama.
Yeah.
So I think that there has been a change in the attitude. I don't know whether that lasts or not, that's another thing, but...
I mean, I don't know if I would say that the Gomeshi thing has shifted any sort of a landscape, but I mean, there's the presumption of innocence, but at the same time that, I mean...
They're like the O'Neill case, for I guess CKNW and their reporters were quite upset about what had been said on their air, and in their news stories had gone out to some shelter or something like that, and had reported on statistics.
Right.
Of what's actually happening in the city that I don't think we would have really known about had this not been a story for them to cover. Just the O'Neill matter, you know?
I know that women at the station were definitely very offended by it, and I think Liza in particular kind of took it into her own hands to report on this.
So back to the point, that, I mean, do you find as a reporter that something has changed in the way we talk to each other, say, or how we listen to each other, especially victims of abuse?
I mean, I feel like there has always been a sensitivity there.
Yeah.
Do you not feel that way?
I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm a guy. I don't know. After the Gomeshi case, after the Cosby case, the fact that some of these victims took so long to say anything, but did say something eventually, suggests that there has been and it showed that there wasn't the sort of atmosphere for them that they could at the time.
Well, I think that that's probably less to do with the media and more to do with the fact that women have numerous reasons not to want to come forward, even if a crime has, without a doubt, been committed against them.
In terms of journalism, I'm digressing dramatically here.
why we got to a dark place real quick, Joe.
We did, yeah. Newspapers, because newspapers tend to get the rap that they are in decline.
Yeah.
Do you think that? I mean, working within a newspaper, do you find that that there is light at the end of the tunnel, if you will?
I mean, I don't think newspapers are dying by any means. I think we're certainly undergoing a big transformation right now. The New York Times issued a report this spring. It was an innovation report, and I think one of the most interesting things to me was that only a third of the readers go to the homepage now. So that suggests that we're not going to thevancouversun.com or globemail.com to see what's happening today. I mean, we're going to the stories directly and that they're being shared. That's a shift in how we are getting the news now.
And so, people always wonder if there'll be a newspaper, say, 5 years down the road. I mean, for you, is that something that you're worried about, say, or thinking about?
I don't know what it's going to look like in the future, and if I did, I think I'd be a very rich lady on, like, the touring circuit right now. But as we get there, I think there's going to be an emphasis on utilizing these new skills. People coming into the industry who can shoot video, who are multidisciplinary, who can do broadcast, and aren't hindered by the experience of journalism as we know it right now. Like, you're not coming into here filing one print story a day. So, fresh set of eyes.
Why for you journalism? I mean, is this something that you always wanted to do, even as a kid?
No, I really liked writing, and I think I kind of went into journalism backwards. I really liked storytelling. So I used to do a lot of, like, long features for music magazines. And then I think the news just kind of followed afterwards when I found out the issues that I cared about most, and finding different ways to tell those stories.
Because I'm 32 and you're younger than I am. I don't recall in my high school class, say, people that were interested in going into journalism. I don't know what your experience was growing up. It doesn't seem like the sort of field that people would think to go into nowadays.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
And there's probably a lot of parents trying to talk them out of it, too.
Prefer them to go to law school or something like
that. Yeah, my dad says I can still be a lawyer.
But journalists of a different generation went into it because of Woodward and Bernstein.
Yeah.
There was nothing like that for you, was there?
No. I mean, it didn't factor into my decision personally anyway.
But there must be people that you admire in terms of what you do.
I admire a lot of the people that I work with, like in my own bureau, I think,
yeah,
who have carved out their niche and are telling these incredible stories about RC. Like Frances Beulah, for instance, I think she's amazing at what she does. I would love to be able to follow like a career trajectory like hers.
Yeah, and she's still at it. She's still...
Yeah.
I mean, she's. If there's anything that happens at Cambie and 12th, I mean, she probably knows about it before everyone else does.
Yeah.
And
she can write about whatever she wants, and people love it because it's fantastic.
So you generally think that we in this city, this market, are well served by the press that we have?
Well, I think there's always well served by our market. What do you mean by that?
Like the sort of reporters that we have working, I mean, they're not on the take or anything like that. You know what I mean? I mean, they generally are there to do a good job, or perhaps I don't know, maybe effect change in some positive way rather than
Absolutely.
Yeah, then use this as a stepping stone to, say, PR or a career in PR.
This is but like absolutely not any sort of a stepping stone to anywhere.
No?
No. We're not in this for the glory.
What do you make of the depiction of the media in popular culture? As I said earlier, you know, the
media... It drives me insane.
Really?
Yeah.
So, like, you probably don't watch The Newsroom, then.
I did, and I haven't started on the new season. But, I mean, it drives me nuts when people say you can't trust the media, because it's just so broad of a generalization. I mean, like, the Georgia Strait is the media, Fox News is the media. And I think it's just so unfair, and every time I hear something like that, it drives me nuts.
And so the media must have a part to play in that, though, don't you think? I mean, sort of propagating these myths about themselves?
Sure, you have some terrible reporters, and you also have ones who work their asses off trying to affect change and do good. And everyone's being lumped into the media.
Do you think it's important for you, because you're on Twitter, you're active on Twitter and Instagram, to cultivate a personality beyond, say, your work? I mean, one of the things that I liked about your work is that you also have this sort of humorous side to you, which I see on Twitter all the time.
Thanks.
Is that important, do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't think it hurts.
Yeah.
Unless you're kind of a jerk, then in that case it's probably better to conceal your personality.
Are there many jerks that you find in the press?
Oh, yeah.
You're free to give names. I think it'd be interesting for me and my audience.
I'll provide you with a list after this.
All right. We've just come off of a municipal election. We've got a federal election in less than a year. We had a provincial election a year or so ago. Politics is something that you report on. What do you make of what's happening on the political scene nowadays in this town, certainly? Do you have any insight from the last two campaigns as to how the federal campaign will go?
No.
No.
No, on that I would have to defer to Mr. Ian Bailey, who is our... it's definitely an interesting one to watch, but it is not my beat at all.
Speaking of Ian Bailey...
Yeah.
He's fascinating on Twitter, because he has, I mean, he's a huge movie fan, I'm assuming, because he's
a big movie and comic nerd.
Yeah, and he reads a lot, and it probably, I mean, it obviously feeds into his work, but, I mean, he has eclectic tastes that suggests that there's a personality there other than just, say, the reporter, and I think that goes into the previous question about how you guys have to, I mean, it's important, isn't it, to get to know the reporter more than just, say, their byline in the paper.
Yeah. I mean, I think this kind of goes back to the fact that people aren't really going to homepages anymore, that they're finding stories. And a lot of the times, they're just getting it from the reporter themselves through Twitter or through whatever. And I think it certainly doesn't hurt to know who it is you're getting your news from, what they're really like, what they care about.
It's year end. This is the last interview for the year for me. What are you, looking back at 2014, was there a story that was particularly memorable for you? I know that Bob Kronbauer at Vancouver's Awesome talked about a piece that you did about that lady who eats regularly at the White Spot on
Rose.
Canby. Yeah, which is a great story, by the way.
Thank you.
Are there stories like that perhaps that stick out for looking back at the year that was?
I think the one that I was most interested in personally was probably the prescription heroin saga, the battle between... know, severely entrenched addicts in Vancouver's downtown east side versus the federal conservative government. It's this kind of David and Goliath battle. Yeah.
And that's something that you wrote about, but other outlets had written about as well.
Well, it's not really. I mean, there have been stories.
Isn't Lupik at...
Travis Lupik at the Georgia Strait has done a fantastic job on that as well. But, I mean, aside from him, you see maybe the odd story, but you haven't really... I've been surprised by how many people have not shown interest in it. I was talking to someone at Providence Healthcare who was trying to get the story out to more news organizations, and he said one managing editor was like, well, our readers aren't heroin addicts, and they just turned down the story. Huh. And I think it's incredibly important. I mean, this is the first time in North America that that were getting heroin-assisted treatment. And this is one of the most marginalized demographics that we have here, and a treatment that could potentially save their lives. And you have a federal health minister changing the regulations to ban this treatment for what can only be seen as ideological reasons. I think it's really interesting and it's important.
Yeah.
I wish more people covered it.
Yeah. And do you see, say, hope in terms of the stories that ought to be covered and that they will be covered in the sort of press that we have in this community? Like, I mean, this goes back to whether we're well-served or not. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I read a lot of criticism of the press that they're ignoring stories all the time. I'm sure you're pitched stuff all the time. You're told of some situation that needs reporting. I'm sure that the Globe and Mail only has certain column inches that they can, you mm-hmm. know, provide to stories happening in British Columbia. That must frustrate you as a journalist in terms of not being able to write what you think would be important.
Well, I do get to write a lot of, if not all of, what I think is really important. I mean, we have a fantastic bureau chief who listens. If I think something is really important, even if she disagrees, I will often be mm-hmm. able to write that. I mean, we can't write everything that we are pitched, mm-hmm. But we live in an interesting time. I mean, people can call us, you can tweet at me and tell me what to write about. Mm-hmm. I think it's a lot more fluid now. There's a lot more of a conversation back and forth between readers and reporters now.
A lot of it is valuable, I mean, but you must get cranks and the sort that have some one issue that they're always trying to...
Yeah, yeah. We can't do every story, but we certainly listen to every idea.
Yeah. Well, this has been terribly interesting for me to talk to you about your work. I'm a big fan of your work, obviously.
Thank you.
And to get this insight into what you do and how you do it, because I think I found it interesting. I'm sure the people listening to us who will find the same. So I appreciate you coming in to do this, especially so close to Christmas.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in. The Globe and Mail's Andrea Wu. Twitter, the Twitter handle is @AndreaWu, and then the website, of course, is AndreaWu.com. Andrea Wu joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponta.